I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The transcendent ex-slave Frederick Douglass has been paired in statesmanship with Abraham Lincoln. David Blight's stunning, big, new biography sets Douglass in parallel also with the literary giant Herman Melville and his novel In Quest of a Whale, Moby Dick. Douglass and Melville turn out to be almost exact contemporaries, consumed in their 20s and 30s with the moral crisis of slavery. The Quaker town of New Bedford, Massachusetts, is where their paths crossed, whether they noticed one another or not. It's where young Frederick dropped his slave name Bailey and took Douglass instead. It's where Ishmael meets the South Sea harpooner Queequeg in Moby Dick. The whale ship they sail, the Pequod and its crew, is Melville's idea of this nation of nations, very like Douglass's ideal of the composite nation. In David Blight's account of Douglass, he's a word man, like Melville, a storyteller who keeps rewriting his autobiography, recomposing his epic of American identity, of tragedy, of evil.
The character Douglass is creating, let's say, in the narrative, the first autobiography, and even more richly in the second, is a self-willed, heroic individual, always working and striving against the odds. And he had great odds. He is a courageous young man who seizes upon words, upon language, on literacy as his weapon, as his only weapon. But I think he's also creating a character who seizes on the weapon of character, of a strong personality. And even the young man who would use physical violence to regenerate himself.
We could do this hour in just personal relationships, but the first one that grabbed me was with Edward Covey, a slave breaker, as they were known, on the eastern shore of Maryland. He had been born in slavery, gets farmed out to Thomas Auld, who finds him a little too rough and ready, and he packs him off to Covey. And they end up in a fight, which is told differently in different autobiographies, but it's critical.
Yeah, it is critical. It's critical to Douglass's self-creation. But Douglass tells the story that one day on a Sunday, when he had returned from temporarily running away to the woods, he stood up to Covey, and according to Douglass, they fought for 2 hours. Now, I don't believe it lasted 2 hours, that they'd killed each other. But Douglass stands up with his fist and fights him off at the age of 17. Now, in any other circumstances, a slave who resisted his master in such a way would be prosecuted, hanged, or at least sold south. But at this point, Covey kept it quiet, according to Douglass, because Covey's pride was at stake. And at the end of this year with Covey, his owner, Thomas Auld, hired him out again to another master, a different farm, just some 5 miles away. That man's name was William Freeland. And when you first read Douglass, you think he's making up these names. It sounds like Toni Morrison characters. But that was Freeland's name and Freeland's farm. In fact, the farmhouse on Freeland's farm is still there. But it was on Freeland's farm. This is the year after standing up to Covey with his fists. He developed what he called his band of brothers. This was a group of from 5 to sometimes 25 slaves who would gather on Sundays in the woods or in brush arbors, and Douglass would preach, or he would teach them oratory out of his little book called The Columbian Orator. And it was among that group, or among 5 of that group of best friends, that they hatched an escape plot, which was never going to work, and they were betrayed and caught. And of course, Douglass will escape when he's 20.
Stick with Covey for a sec, because I think it's the second autobiography that he says, that's when I became a man. And in some sense, there's a little bit of self-reliance about it, but also he's modeling what you got to do.
He does make this case, a familiar case in American literature, of this male resurrection through violence, resistance through violence as an act of self-creation. And he does make it into a pivot of the autobiography.
Absolutely.
No question. A turning point where he had finally overtly and physically resisted. And I'll say this, too, in so much of Douglass's writings, Douglass was always much more worried about the power of slavery over his mind than he was over his body.
That Covey fight, though, also smacks of the almost revolutionary edge in Frederick Douglass all his life. I want you to consider, as another personal relationship, the way he was drawn to John Brown.
Sure.
He knew about John Brown's plan to attack the arsenal at Harper's Ferry.
He did.
But then he skipped town in a certain way. And he wrote later, "I've always been more distinguished for running than fighting."
The relationship between Brown and Douglass is actually quite fascinating. I think I counted 11 times they actually met. Hmm. From the first time they met in 1847 near Springfield, Massachusetts, all the way to their last encounter in 1859 there in the summer before the raid. Hmm. What interested Douglass about Brown came from an increasing desire and increasing desperation among a lot of abolitionists in the 1850s, Douglass was hardly alone in this, that they were running out of options. They were running out of moral options especially, running out of even political options. And he was willing to listen. In fact, you know, Brown spent a full month at Douglass's house in Rochester in the winter of 1858. They housed him up in a kind of an attic apartment. And Douglass's teenage kids were fascinated by this guy who would get out all these maps and show them the forts and so on. But what Douglass was interested in was Brown's idea that he sort of vaguely kept expressing, that he was going to get enough men to set up a series of forts beginning in the Upper South, of Virginia, a Kentucky, a Maryland, and then a series of forts of some kind into the northern states, presumably Pennsylvania, maybe Ohio, and funnel slaves out of the South in this kind of subterranean, he called it subterranean passageway, the military underground railroad. Douglass listened on this, which is a measure of Douglass's own desperation by the late 1850s. But when Douglass learned in 59 that Brown had his eyes on Harper's Ferry, and then when Frederick Douglass went down near Harper's Ferry to Chambersburg, Pennsylvania in August of 59, met with Brown for 48 hours, where Brown tried to convince him to join him, that's when Douglass told Brown, "No, this is crazy. You're attacking the largest federal arsenal in the United States. The United States government and its army are going to swarm. You're all going to be captured and killed." And Douglass walked away. Now, he had the great good sense not to follow this revolutionary once he learned what the plan was. And today, you know, you can get up quite an argument with some Americans who know their history but love John Brown. And I, for one, have turned in my membership of the John Brown Sainthood Club only to the extent that, thankfully, Douglass had the good sense to see that this plan was suicidal. And so, he walked away, and if he hadn't, he'd have been hanged.
The whole story reminds you that Douglass is, first and foremost, and maybe only, a writer. He's a masterful writer. He's not a warrior.
He's a speaker, a writer, an intellectual, charismatic speaker and writer. But he admitted himself, he'd never been a warrior. I know no evidence that he'd ever owned a firearm.
And yet, his whole persona was advocating revolutionary struggle over slavery, as Abraham Lincoln did not want. And it's funny, in the 1960s, and today, somebody's quoting these lines from Douglass, in which he said, talking about agitation, this was 1859, right about Harper's Ferry time, he said, "No struggle, no progress, basically. This struggle," he says, "may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, and it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and never will."
Yes. Again, this is a process for Douglass. In the 1840s, he's still a Garrisonian, meaning a follower of William Lloyd Garrison, trying to be a non-resistant, a pacifist, trying to be anti-political parties, trying to be anti-constitution, especially trying to toe the line about uses of violence. But in the 1850s, beginning early in that decade, Douglass begins to shoulder up to the possibilities of the uses of violence, partly again out of a lack of other options, partly because of the influence of some other abolitionists, and partly because of the increasingly revolutionary situation of the slavery crisis. Right. The Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, and then the many attempts to rescue fugitive slaves, which Boston had its share.
Lots.
This radicalized people, including Douglass, that, you know, if there's slave catchers in your neighborhood and they're trying to seize a fugitive slave, what do? You don't lay down.
Mm.
This goes back to the fact that Douglass carried out of him at age 20 out of slavery a rage, an anger, a hatred that had to somehow be processed. And once the war finally comes, by 1861, Douglass had what he had always hoped for.
Blood and disunion.
Yes. And once the war came, Douglass became, and again I have a whole chapter on this, one of the most violent war propagandists America's ever had. He advocated the killing of every slaveholder in the South. Why should they be killed? Because they deserve to be killed.
Right.
He went so far as to say, just being a slaveholder makes you a traitor. Slaveholding is treasonous to the natural rights tradition, to the Constitution, to the Bill of Rights, and so forth. Douglass's war propaganda, when you first read it in 1862 or so, is shocking at first. He even invented stories about what Confederate soldiers were doing to the bodies of the Union dead. He was creating the horrible Hun. But he'd been rehearsing doing that for 25 years in all of his other forms of writing, and the war just unleashed it.
Coming up, your 4th of July. That does not include me or my people, Douglass put it in an early masterpiece of speechmaking. David Blight hears Biblical Rage and a symphony in three movements. This is Open Source. Frederick Douglass was a famous face before he'd formally bought himself out of slavery. He was speaking all over New England and the North on his mission to make visible the wounds of this system on my soul. In David Blight's telling, the Douglass presence was everywhere, including the British Isles.
He wasn't even in his mid-20s, and he could hold an audience for an hour and a half and have them laughing and crying. That was power, and the only power he had.
Speak about that gaze. I feel that gaze. I mean, in so many pictures, every one of them striking, storytelling, expressive.
Yeah, they are. Everywhere he went, photographers wanted him to sit for photographs. He also cultivated these photographs over and over. He liked doing this. And if he didn't like the profile that the photographer took in the morning, he'd go back in the afternoon and get it done right. Douglass had a visage. He had a presence. He had an incredible charisma. And one of the things I found many, many, many accounts of were people in the press or in letters describing the first time they saw Douglass, first time they heard Douglass speak, or the second time they heard Douglass and comparing it to the first. There are many descriptions of the sounds of his voice, his mannerisms, his style, and so forth. And this was, we need to remember, the golden age of oratory.
And the birth of photography.
And the birth of photography. And Douglass loved modernity, by the way. He loved the things of modernity. And it's worth kind of remembering that he is born 1818 before steamboats, the railroad, the rotary press, which he will use, of course, to a great extent, the telegraph. All of these elements of 19th century modernity, which made possible a massive, you know, reform movement like anti-slavery, Douglass is born before that even happens. But he lives all the way to electric light bulbs.
David Blight, come to 1852 and a speech that is now sort of classic and a lot of young kids know it. The 4th of July speech may be his great masterpiece, may be his popular masterpiece for all time.
The 4th of July speech Douglass gives in 1852 is, in my opinion, the rhetorical masterpiece of American abolitionism, one of the great speeches of American history. It's now canonized in lots of collections of oratory and speeches and even literature.
And read at street corners.
Read at street corners. The state of Vermont has a statewide policy on the 4th. Every town is supposed to read it. But the speech itself, the context is in part everything. It's summer of 1852. Uncle Tom's Cabin's just been published. It is taking the world by storm. It's a presidential election year. It's 2 years into the attempted enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act. There are rescues going on around the country. Several of them have already occurred. Douglass has participated in two or three of them. The crisis over slavery is beginning to break apart the political parties. And Douglass gets invited by his friends in Rochester, the Ladies Anti-Slavery Society of Rochester, New York, to give a speech in Corinthian Hall, which was this big, beautiful, new hall in Rochester. It fit about 600 people. The place was packed. And Douglass, there's a letter in which Douglass tells us he worked harder on that speech than anything else he'd ever written, except perhaps the narrative. He said he spent 3 weeks on it. But the speech is, I call it a symphony in three movements. It's an opening of 6 pages or so where he sets his audience at ease in a calm voice. He talks about the founding fathers as geniuses. The Declaration of Independence is the ring bolt, he says, of your independence. It's a celebration for 6 pages or so. And then the pronouns rain down on you. Your, you, you, you. He addresses his audience, the audience in that room that day. But this speech was addressed to the nation. He already had it printed up, ready to take on the road to sell for probably 50 cents a copy. The second movement of the speech, which is the whole middle of the speech, the longest part of the speech, comes after he says, "But pardon me, why have you invited me here to speak on your 4th of July? The 4th of July is yours. You may rejoice, I must mourn. You, 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 you. You do not," meaning white America, "does not include me and my people in this celebration."
"What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us, the blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today?"
And in that middle part of the speech, he takes them through the historical litany of the slave trade, the holds of a slave ship. He appeals to their senses. He tells them what it smelled like. He tells them what it sounded like. And then he makes them listen and hear the sounds of the chains on a slave and the sounds of a whip. He tells them to see the blood dripping off the back of a slave being savagely beaten. It's like a hailstorm through the whole middle of the speech for 12 pages. And that section comes to an end with a passage that is one step better than Jonathan Edwards. This speech is a great Jeremiah. He ends with the image of a terrible reptile coiled up at the nation's heart and about to eat out your heart. "Unless you repent, you reform, you change." And then comes this last short part of the speech. It's calmer. It's as though he's handed out towels and let everybody dry off. And he says, but your country is still malleable. It's still young and malleable. It is still possible to save yourselves by ending slavery, destroying this system, and recreating the nation. And then, of course, the speech ends, so richly ironic, with the verses of a song, a poem, written by William Lloyd Garrison, Go Sound the Jubilee. And the fact that he would do that in 1852, right after he's just had this horrible personal breakup with Garrison, is richly ironic. So it's a speech that is full of the terror of the great Puritan Jeremiah, but with the possibility of redemption at the end of it. I suspect it's read today and used today so much, partly just because of the power and beauty of the language, but also it's used in places where people want audiences, they want their neighbors, they want their friends to think about the 4th of July as something other than just fireworks and hamburgers and celebration. They want them to think about its history. Think about where Americans have come from. Think about what we had to overcome to have a peaceful republic such as it is. And no one ever put it better than Douglass did by saying, your country will be destroyed by slavery unless you repent and save it now, and it might even be destroyed anyway. Now, that comes out of Douglass's deep intellectual, moral, emotional ties to the Old Testament stories.
Right.
That's where that comes from. In fact, the language Douglass employs, especially in his oratory, but also in a lot of his writing, is really right out of the King James language.
David Blight, come to the great relationship of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
A historic pair, obviously, and endlessly reviewable. They had studied one another carefully, warily, at multiple levels of politics and character and strategy before they met. And then I didn't know that he met Lincoln virtually by barging into the White House through the favor seekers line.
Right.
Lincoln received him, though he was uninvited, and according to Douglass said, Mr. Douglass, I know you. I have read about you.
Right.
Fascinating that Douglass's beef that he wanted to take up with Lincoln was unequal pay for the black soldiers in the Union Army.
Right.
Take us there. And these two men.
Sure. When Douglass went to the White House, as you suggest, on his own, no invitation.
Elbowed his way up the stairs.
Got in line, elbowed his way in, gave his card and said, please let me in. And Lincoln apparently did get the message and said, send him in ahead of a bunch of white people. So walking in, Douglass said he was called the N-word by several people standing in line.
Hmm.
That meeting probably didn't last longer than a half hour, 45 minutes. Douglass went there to protest unequal pay and discriminations against black soldiers. This is summer, 1863. Emancipation Proclamation has been in effect since January. The recruitment of black soldiers has been going on for 8 months. But clearly Lincoln charmed him, because Douglass went away from that meeting and said, quote, I felt big there. He was awed by Lincoln. And Lincoln did say, I've read you, I've followed you, I know a lot about you. Now, they're going to meet again 1 year later in the most remarkable meeting. That's August of 1864. This is in the middle of the stalemate of the war. The war is in total stalemate in Virginia. The war is in stalemate in Georgia, in front of Atlanta. The war is in stalemate in Mobile Bay. And Lincoln, with good reason, believed he might not be reelected in the fall. It's easy to forget that Lincoln's reelection was never a foregone conclusion. There had even been a dump Lincoln movement within the Republican Party in favor of John C. Fremont, a somewhat more radical candidate. That didn't succeed. This time, though, Lincoln invites Douglass as sort of the spokesman of black America, and he asked Douglass to create, to be the principal agent of a system that would funnel slaves, as many as possible, out of the upper South into the North, behind Union lines, into legal freedom before Election Day, in case Lincoln was defeated, such that slavery would be so damaged, there would be so many slaves freed, that at least some major elements of the emancipation process would be secure if McClellan, George McClellan, and the Democrats win the presidency. Because the Democrats, though they had a vague and bizarre platform, were probably going to negotiate some kind of settlement with the Confederacy, a negotiated peace. Now, Douglas was stunned. There's Abraham Lincoln looking him in the eye and saying, would you be a kind of official legal John Brown for me? You know, funnel all these slaves.
Sounds like John Brown's scheme.
It does. And Douglas had no clue exactly how he was supposed to do this. All he was told is that he would do this with the army. He would do this with army officers. And he was asked to go back home to Rochester and call all of his friends, abolitionist friends, people who had been involved in recruiting black soldiers, and set up a series of agents who would begin to put this plan in place. Barely 2 weeks went by. And suddenly, the war changed. The Northern morale changed. And it now looked like, as bloody and horrible as it was, this war is going to be completed. The North is likely to win. And that plan just was abandoned.
Meantime, there's this strong suspicion on Douglas's part that Lincoln would colonize, would send black Americans to Haiti, maybe back to Africa. Was that Lincoln's notion?
Mm-hmm.
Douglas was dead set against it, of course. He said, we are
born
and educated Americans. We have been assimilated. Thank you.
Right. Birthright.
And fight to the death rather than go back anyplace. What was the reality under that? And was it one of many instances of Lincoln temporizing or playing with an idea?
Right.
What do you think?
Well, colonization under the Lincoln administration was a real idea. Make no mistake. There were schemes afloat to create a colony off the coast of Haiti. There was a scheme to set up a black colony in Nicaragua. There were others. And up until the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, September 1862, Lincoln was still his administration was still forthrightly working on these schemes of removal of freed slaves, as many as was in some way possible. And by the way, along the way, in late summer and fall of 1862, the same Montgomery Blair, in Lincoln's cabinet, tried to recruit Douglas to become the head of colonization for the Lincoln administration.
My word.
And one of the angriest, most embittered letters Douglas ever wrote was this long answer to Montgomery Blair,
imagine,
where he told him where he could put this idea of colonization. He laid it all out. He said, we were born here, we will die here. We deserve to be citizens here, we are citizens here. At the very time slavery may be finally eroding and dying in this massive war, how dare you suggest I lead your efforts to remove my people? I will not do it. And he publicizes the letter. Nothing publicly made Douglas any angrier than when the Lincoln administration tried to recruit him to run colonization that autumn. There's no mention of colonization in the final Emancipation Proclamation. And it calls for the recruitment of black men as soldiers. You're not going to remove and colonize people you've asked to serve in the uniform of the United States and go off and die for the nation yet. You're not going to do that. Douglas has never met Lincoln. He's read a lot about him, and he's read Lincoln's public papers and public statements, but they've never met.
But he's felt the ambiguity in this temporizing,
tremendous
compromising
ambiguity.
Character.
And Lincoln had no more bitter critic in the first year of the war than Douglas. Douglas, in his newspaper in 61 and early 62, was just blistering Lincoln, especially over the issue of fugitive slaves. And you may know the official policy of the Lincoln administration and of the Union Army fall of 61 through the spring of 62 was that all fugitive slaves escaping to Union lines were supposed to be returned if their owners were loyal. Now, that was never workable. I mean, how are you going to find out if the owner is loyal? But the official policy was the return of fugitive slaves. Douglas looked at this policy and said, no, what are you doing? The war was caused by slavery. You can't possibly fight it and win it without destroying slavery. The longer the war, of course, much more likely that emancipation would become part of the cause of the war. And it's one of the reasons. Douglas not only wanted war once it broke out, he wanted a long war. And sometimes it's not happy and pretty to be on the side of the people who want a long war. I have often called it in my teaching, it's really the pivot of American history.
1862, 1864.
Yeah. And it's not over until it's over, but the end of slavery meant the possibility, now even the necessity, of a redefined America.
Coming up, Frederick Douglass sounds the thematic chord of his life. There is no Negro problem, as he finally spelled it out. The problem is whether the American people have loyalty enough, honor enough, patriotism enough to live up to their own constitution. This is Open Source. David Blight's life of Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, reveals a gift from the start for what in 2018 is called intersectionality in movement politics. He was the only black person at Seneca Falls.
That's right.
He had an interesting, sometimes tense, relation with the suffragettes, particularly when it came to who should get the vote first, women or black people. Explain all that.
Well, first of all, Douglass was in every way a women's rights man. He even wrote an essay by that title, I Am a Women's Rights Man. He was the only black at the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848. He was the only primary male speaker at the Seneca Falls Convention. He signed the Declaration of Rights. He put a new masthead on his paper, which said, right is of no color nor sex. And he had a very strong relationship with the leaders of the women's suffrage movement.
And his neighbor is Susan B. Anthony in Rochester, right?
Well, they're neighbors now for the purpose of tourism. They weren't really neighbors when they lived there. They're now neighbors in a statue, even. No, the truth is, he was very close to lots of women's rights activists. He traveled with them. He spoke with them, because some of them were the same, suffragists and abolitionists. And during the Civil War, as many people know, the women's suffrage movement, by and large, folded their tents and fought for black freedom. Stanton, in fact, wrote one of the greatest eulogies of all of Douglass. She's the one who said he was, quote, majestic in his wrath, which is a great phrase. Anthony was with Douglass the day he died. Douglass attended a women's rights convention on the last day of his life in Washington, D.C., and he sat on the stage, and he sat next to Susan Anthony. And then he took the carriage home and dropped dead of a heart attack at 6 p.m. But he had far more women friends among these reform movements than he actually did male friends.
In some way, the most delicious piece in the relationship of Lincoln and Douglass comes 10 years later, when Douglass dedicates the Freedmen's Monument in Washington, D.C. It's a statue, and we have one exactly like it in Boston.
A replica right here in Boston.
The standing Lincoln, his left arm raised over a black man, taking a knee, if I may say. I mean,
you may.
Not quite kneeling, but Douglass recoiled at that image.
Yes.
He wanted to call it a people's monument.
Right.
And he began his speech talking about Lincoln not as the great emancipator, but as preeminently the white man's president.
Right.
And then the speech takes an amazing turn before it's over.
Does. I often say that that's Douglass's second greatest speech.
I think so,
and
too.
I opened
Maybe
the book
the greatest.
With it because it just seemed like a moment to place this story right there toward the end of Reconstruction with everything at stake that had been won in the war. That speech is really about Reconstruction.
Yes.
And the retreat from Reconstruction. And note the audience he had. The entire government was there. President Grant, members of the president's cabinet, congressmen, senators, members of the Supreme Court. It's everybody that would be at a state event, at inauguration. No black person had ever addressed that group at once. Mm. And no black person ever did again until Barack Obama was inaugurated. Mm.
I have said that President Lincoln was a white man and shared the prejudices common to his countrymen towards the colored race. Viewed from the genuine abolition ground, Mr. Lincoln seemed tardy, cold, dull, and indifferent. But measuring him by the sentiment of his country, a sentiment that he was bound as a statesman to consult, he was swift, zealous, radical, and determined. Though Mr. Lincoln shared the prejudices of his white fellow countrymen against the Negro, it is hardly necessary to say that in his heart of hearts, he loathed and hated slavery. The man who could say, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray that this mighty scourge of war should soon pass away. Yet if God wills, it continue till all the wealth piled by 200 years of bondage shall have been wasted, and each drop of blood drawn by the lash shall have been paid for by one drawn by the sword. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Gives all needed proof of his feeling on the subject of slavery.
It's an honest speech. He says, look, and this is, by the way, election year, 1876. It's the
centennial year.
Year of the American centennial. Is Reconstruction going to last or die? Is right on the table. And it comes in the wake of so much brutal use of violence and terror across the South now for years. Douglas says, Abraham Lincoln was preeminently the white man's president. He was your president, not ours. You, my white fellow Americans, were his children. I and my people, only his stepchildren, which he repeats like a mantra. You read that first part of the speech and you do a kind of an ouch. Whoa, he's the white man's president. This is going to be a black nationalist diatribe against Lincoln and the country. No, it's not. What he does then, he shifts and he says, but under his rule and in due time, and he makes that a refrain three or four times, under his Lincoln's rule and in due time, we were liberated. We became free. We became equal before law in the 14th Amendment. We got the right to vote in the 15th Amendment under his rule and in due time, which was Douglas's way, I believe, of saying the United States freed us. The United States gave us our rights, and the United States is bound to enforce and protect that. And who's sitting in front of him but the United States, the President, the Supreme Court, the Congress? And it ends with a sort of peroration about Reconstruction and about whether this will be saved or not. And of course, it's also laced beautifully with all that civil religion. He talks about the dead lying in yonder Arlington. He talks about the majestic dome of the Capitol. I mean, it's full of the sort of beauty of patriotism. I see it as a great Reconstruction speech because it comes right as Reconstruction is falling apart on the eve of that presidential election, which is, of course, when the bargain is struck that, in effect, does bring a kind of political end, at least, to Reconstruction. It's Douglas's attempt at a last hurrah to try to rally his own party now, which is still in power, to hold Reconstruction together.
The lynching speech was the last of the great ones, perhaps.
Yeah. He's confronted by the issue of lynching from really the late 1880s on, but especially in the early 90s. Ida B. Wells had some influence on that because of her great activism about lynching, and they became quite close. He became a kind of mentor to her. But he first fashioned the speech while he was in Chicago, representing the nation of Haiti at the Chicago World's Fair. And he took a version of it on the road called Lessons of the Hour, also sometimes called Why is the Negro Lynched? It's actually a very good analysis of how this came out of the culture, out of the society. And it's no holds barred. It's an embittered speech. It's an ugly speech. It's a difficult speech to even read at times because he uses examples from the press of actual lynchings. He talks about the white audiences celebrating, which we've now learned much, much more about, at a lynching. But in essence, that speech, given in the last years of his life, is Douglas saying, all that we fought for, all that we won, the great triumphs and rebirth of the United States is possibly being destroyed now by this phenomenon. He has a very difficult time in that speech doing what he usually did through his life, which is to find some kind of way to end on hope. But he does it. Like it or not, he ends on this faith that still somehow the creeds of the Constitution will prevail.
Amazing.
Where else could he go? But to the 14th and 15th Amendments, where else could he go? But to these creeds of natural rights, which is where he'd always gone, even way back 40 years earlier when arguing for the destruction of slavery. But it is remarkable that he ends his life. He doesn't end his life an unhappy man by any means. He had a very rich domestic situation by the end of his life, and he was comfortable. But what's happening out in society was a cause of great despair, and it's vividly illustrated in that speech, Lessons of the Hour.
He didn't need to share much about his private life, his married life, first to Anna, a slave woman who did not grow intellectually the way he did, or his lady friends, or his second marriage, or the many children, two who had been in the Civil War And fought over the legacy. I mean, do we need to know?
Yes, we do, because I think in any biography worth its salt, even if the person is a great public figure, president to whatever, the private situation, the domestic life, the personal standing, the emotional standing can often have everything to do with how they perform in public. And in this case, there are any number of instances where Douglas and his cause and his enterprise of his newspaper, for example, would never have survived without the great help of some of these people, namely his wife Anna, who raised five children and kept a home against the odds, but also an English woman named Julia Griffiths, who spent 6 years with Douglas from 1849 to 1855, living in the Douglas home much of that time. His co-editor, his fundraiser, strong emotional support, and indeed his editor. And she wrote a lot of letters in which she describes his health conditions. Douglas had, by any measure, in my view, a nervous breakdown in 1851 and 52. He had periods when he was bedridden, couldn't use his limbs for a month at a time. He even admitted it himself in his newspaper. I cannot write for the paper this month. My friend Julia will be writing the editorials. I am incapacitated, and so forth. He's in his early 30s. He's the self-made man who can't feed his kids. It's a crisis. So if you don't go there as a biographer, think what you're leaving out. Or then a woman from Germany came into his life named Ottilia Assing. And Ottilia Assing came to America in about 1853 or 54 to cover the American abolition movement for a German magazine called Der Morgenblatt. And in 1855, she read My Bondage and My Freedom and was knocked out of her shoes by it, so to speak. And she traveled out to Rochester in 1856 to interview Douglas. And in effect, Ottilia Assing from 1856 on tried never to leave. And they had a relationship, friendship, of some 22 years. And then there's the second marriage to Helen Pitts, which is, by all accounts, a wonderful marriage. The last 12 years of Douglas's life, he was married to this also very well-educated white woman. And it was, by the way, the most scandalous marriage of the 19th century. There are whole volumes of newspaper clippings just about the marriage.
And why? Just because it was black and white?
Black and white is the principal reason, and Helen was 20 years younger. So the family dynamic around this was very complicated, and I'll just say one other thing about that. The marriage was terrific. They went on an 11-month tour of Europe and the Mediterranean. She traveled with him. They read all kinds of books together. But Douglas woke up every day from the 1870s on, after he moved to Washington, with his family being written about in the local press, or the Washington press. They became what I call in this book the Black First Family. Everything they did, good, bad, and ugly. If they got into lawsuits, if they got into trouble, whatever happened, the sons, the daughter, anything, it's in the press. And Douglas ended up with 4 adult children, 21 grandchildren, all of whom, to one extent or another, ended up dependent on him financially, which shapes many of the decisions of his life, shapes his constant need to be out on the road.
Work.
As an traveling orator. He probably was heard by more Americans as an orator in the 19th century than any other American. I can't prove that.
Including Mark Twain.
Well, Mark Twain's the only competitor. Twain probably traveled more miles because Twain went to Asia. Douglas never went to Asia.
I find it amazing that he could keep that schedule without airlines. But also, more important maybe, the man was free. Mm-hmm. He was advocating bloody revolution, mm-hmm. and he could still walk into the White House and see mm-hmm. the President of the United States. There was an abandon and a candor and a directness about everything he wrote, and he survived. I mean, would that happen today?
Well, we don't know, do we? I was asked the other night at a book talk, why wasn't Douglas assassinated? That was the question. Well, he was attacked many times.
On stage, here at Tremont Temple, there were fist fights around his
speech. Famous rumble in Tremont Temple, where the reporter for a Boston paper said he fought like a pugilist. One of the reasons more abolitionists weren't killed is because people didn't have guns.
Praise God.
People didn't just carry sidearms then, the way we might think of it now. But never think for a moment that he wasn't attacked.
Summing up, David Blight, account for the incredible modern ring of this voice on a lot of issues, but just the clarity of a tough-minded, realistic Black voice. It sounds like Michelle Alexander. It sounds like Bryan Stevenson. It sounds like Malcolm and Martin and Cornel West, and in some way, but not exactly, Ta-Nehisi Coates. I mean, this is a voice in our midst again.
Well, frankly, they're all rewriting Douglas to some extent, as have many, many, many African-American poets of the 20th century, as have many writers of the 20th century. It begins, though, with Douglas's amazing capacity to find in words the essence of a dilemma, of a pivot in history, of a problem. And that's why I have used the word prophet in the title of this book. He was a prophet because, like the Old Testament prophets, like some people we might have identified in our own history, a Nelson Mandela, a Martin Luther King, who found the language to tell us who we were at a given time, who found the language to describe a dilemma and make us hurt. At the end of the day, Douglas is his words. The reason you and I are talking about him are Douglas's words, far more than any of his actions, other than escaping from slavery. We talk about Douglas because of what he wrote and what he spoke. And that, I think, will always be the case.
David Blight, thank you so much. This is a book that not only recreates a character, but a time, an energy, a vision, a passion. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It's very kind of you to have me.
David Blight's book is called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Thanks to James Milord, who played Frederick Douglass for us. We recorded him at the African Meeting House on Beacon Hill in Boston, where Frederick Douglass himself spoke more than once. Our show this week was produced by a band of brothers and sisters, Connor Gillies, Rebecca Panovka, Susan Coyne, our engineer George Hicks, and his right hand, Matt Lissette. Mary McGrath runs our railroad. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.